Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with Kirk about prophetic events. Kirk, when we were talking about the Apophis, and the fact that this asteroid bearing the same name that Yahweh uses in Revelation, being in Yahweh predicting that it was going to strike at the midpoint in the tribulation, which he provides the dating so that we can know on our calendar that it's Friday, April 13th, 2029. And then we find out in 2004 that a asteroid has been found that scientists named Apophis, the same name, and that it's supposed to come within the Earth's satellite orbit on Friday, April 13th, 2029. And that... And that if this thing is nudged gravitationally or by another object in its as it goes off into the solar system and comes back, which, by the way, when Yahweh's explaining Apophis, he uses the Greek term, he actually translated using the Greek term, balo. You know what balo means in Greek?
Is it push or...
Yeah, to nudge. Yeah, to nudge. It's going to be nudged. That's what he says. And that's the last part, it's going to be nudged. Yeah. And it's going to strike the earth. Now, if you're just a rational individual, and you read in a that this asteroid is... going to strike, and you, and that is predicted to strike, and written about. You know, this was written in 69 CE, is when Revelation was committed to writing. Mm-hmm. That in 69 CE, God inspired Jaokonan to write down that an asteroid named Apophis is going to strike the Earth, and not destroy the Earth. It's not going to be a life ending event. It's going to destroy about a third of the Earth. It's going to occur on this date, and then you find that in 2004 scientists found that asteroid, gave it the same name, and that's when it's going to strike, and it's of the size that is going to do that much damage. It doesn't do that much damage all by itself, because what it says is that along with the asteroid striking, there's the side of a volcanic mountain that is going to give way, and it's going to create tidal waves.
So that can somewhere now.
Yeah, that specific mountain is well known. It's off it's part of the Canary Islands off the coast of Spain. It's a volcanic island that has a fissure that is just a matter of time before an event triggers its collapse. And it will create a tidal wave that will be in the range of several hundred feet tall that's going to race across the Pacific Ocean at about 500 miles an hour. Everything along the shoreline in the Americas, which would be where, a third of our population lives, if not more, gone.
Wouldn't that hit Western Europe as well? I mean,
yes.
Would it go the other way?
London's essentially underground. I mean, it's below sea level.
Anyway. No.
But yes, most of England, much if not most of France, and all of the low-lying countries of the north, like Spain, Portugal, all the low-lying countries in the north. Yeah, the Netherlands, for example, gone.
In addition to that, you know, NASA had a show on TV where they had their plan for it was to, or for anything like this, they have satellites they're going to send out that are going to actually hit the things and push them out of the way.
Yeah, what's interesting is
we may be the ones that nudge it right into ourselves. Anyway.
Yeah, that's
point. We usually do all the damage ourselves when you get.
That's exactly the point that Yoel, my good friend, does. Mm-hmm. He and his family are visiting, and we were talking about it last night. Mm-hmm. And he says it's funny, we may actually be the ones who do the nudging. Specific to Apophis, NASA is trying to get funding for two programs, and it's specific for Apophis. The first is to put land a probe on Apophis so that its orbit can be tracked, so we have a little more warning as to it striking the Earth, because they're quite concerned that somewhere out there it is going to get nudged and it's going to hit. And the second is
Australia, huh?
Yeah, that's right. The second is that, that's right, let's go to Australia and New Zealand. The second is that they recognize that the likelihood of it hitting is so concerning. They're developing, they want to develop one of about four or five different technologies to deflect it.
Yeah, that was in the show, yeah. They're working very hard on that, too.
Yes.
Oh, speaking of UOL, he does such a wonderful thing on the Christmas holiday. Remember his research he did one time as a guest when
yes.
he took over your show one time?
Yes.
Ask him to do it again. I mean, I think it's terrific.
Yeah. Yeah, his presentation on the origins of Christmas is something that we're still going to
love. Yours now, you understand. I'm just...
Yeah, no, love for him.
We miss him. We ain't heard him in years, so it's about
time. Yeah, I know. It's been years. Yeah, I'm going to see if I can get him to participate in the Torah program this afternoon on Blog Talk Radio. But, you know, if you are listening to this and that you realize that Yahweh laid out a timeline and then provided all of the details along the way as to what man was going to do to himself and what was going to be happening in the world around us. I mean, including the climate change that we're witnessing today, including the increase in earthquakes, including the increase in wars, including the increase in terrorism, specifically of who was going to be killing whom where. Specific even to Damascus and this war in Syria that is going to engulf the world. That somewhere along the way, wouldn't you think that if you're a rational individual, you'd say, you know, there's no chance that the author of this book, written over hundreds of years, just happened to get all this right, that he is really the ultimate guesser of all time?
Now, what do you put that down to when people just don't get? I mean, you throw out a few facts like that, and I've done that, and I know you've done that, and they
right.
just go like their eyes just roll over. It's like
yeah. Well, give me another example is that when you come to realize that the cosmic radiation that's emanating out of out from the Big Bang, and Big Bang is the term that Yahweh himself coined 3,500 years ago. When you realize that the timeline has been stretched by 10 to the 12th, that means that as a witness to creation, at the point of creation, time flowed 10 to the 12th slower than it does for us, which is the very nature of relativity. And you take the 15 billion years that the universe has existed. I know they say 13.7 in terms of since the Big Bang, but time just didn't flow prior to the cooling of energy to the point that it could form matter. Only when matter exists does time actually flow. And if you divide 10 to the 12th by the 15 billion years, you get to 6 24-hour days. And when you do that and you realize that every aspect of creation is the right order and exactly what we have learned has occurred, and you just roll your eyes, which is something desperately wrong with you. I mean, it means that you can't be reached with evidence and reason, that there is no proving the most profound inspiration in the universe.
When I was a teenager, I read, my uncle had a drugstore, and there was a guy sat there, and he asked me, do you believe those things in the Bible, as he would say, were true? And he said, what about the sun staying up forever, you know, for 24 hours and things like that? And he said, well, why don't you read this book? And it was Emmanuel Velikovsky's book. And basically what I got out of that long before I got to the stage I am now, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But the sun stands up for Joshua or Yahshua, which
right.
is Osha. But
yeah.
at the same time, the Aztecs or the Incas, I forget which, are recording that at the same time the sun doesn't come up for 24 hours over there. So after a while, you say, I don't know how these guys knew, but by George, somebody knew. Because they're writing prophecy after prophecy, and then the same thing with... And you find the records of Egypt, of the plagues in Egypt, or you can go up to the Holland, and there they are. They're written the same thing. They weren't written by Moshe, but they were recorded by these people. So,
yeah, really interesting.
Really
interesting in terms of Egypt is if you look at, Yosef was exiled into Egypt by his brothers. And when he came there, he earned a position of power by correctly interpreting the Pharaoh's dream. And the dream that he interpreted, and we can date this to the specific time that Yosef was there, and which show it was that the 7 years of plenty, of perfect conditions for growing crops, were going to be followed by 7 years of devastating years for growing crops in Egypt. And so that was the interpretation of the dream. And Pharaoh said, you know, I'm going to believe you. It sounds credible to me. And he turned over to Yosef the responsibility of building storehouses for the bumper crops of grain and other food crops during those 7 years of plenty. And there were seven huge years and of plenty, and then followed by the 7 years of drought. Now you might say, okay, so that's the Torah's story on the whole thing. Why are you bringing this up? Because we have found Yosef's home in Egypt at the time. We have found the storehouses that he built, which were constructed at the time that he was there for the express purpose of storing the food. And in the Nile, there's places where the Nile goes through cataracts, which are rocky sides, where we can look at the sediments as to what the flow pattern was of the Nile year after year, going all the way back into antiquity. And right at the time that Yosef lived, we find that there were 7 years of perfect Nile flooding, which, because the flooding is important. Too much flooding, you destroy crops. No flooding, you can't grow crops. We find 7 years of perfect conditions followed by 7 years of horrific conditions. All of it's there.
Yeah.
You know, you look at the Exodus, and there's idiots that say, you know, there's no proof that Jews were ever in Israel and the Exodus never occurred. Well, the fact is that in Goshen now there are many digs that show the presence of the Israelites there, that show that they did making bricks and making homes and palaces and buildings for the Egyptians. All there, that the young men were killed in the at the age that that the book of Genesis, Bereshith, and the Torah says they were killed, and shows that they exited at the time that the Torah's account said they exited. And then there's remnants of the Egyptians trying to chase them off of Nuweiba Beach on the Gulf of Aqaba branch of the Red Sea. All of it's there to look at.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Somewhere along the way, Kirk, it goes from being improbable to impossible that all of what God had to say shows out, proves out to be true, not only historically, but prophetically. Another example beyond all this is that if you were to use Google Earth, and you were to look at the area directly across from Nuweiba Beach in Arabia, across the Gulf of Aqaba, you can look down and see the burn top of Mount Horeb, where Yahweh's burning fire consumed the top of the mountain. You can see the place where Moshe struck the rock and water gushed out, visible. You can see the chain link fence that and guard tower that Saudi Arabians have put around it because they don't want anybody there because it proves the Torah as opposed to the Quran. And you can even see where the altar to the golden calf was erected. All of it's still visible. All you got to do is look at Google Earth.
And this makes the news.
Yeah, and of course, yeah. Another example. In Turkey, there is a national park in Turkey to Noah's Ark. And you can Google Noah's Ark Turkish National Park, and you'll find out exactly where it is. It's not too far from Lake Van, towards the mountain range of Arafat. And then you can use Google Earth to hone in on that national park. And you can see the Ark. I mean, it's right there before your eyes. You can absolutely see the Ark. You know, how much historical evidence do you need? You know, when the prophet Yeshaya and others wrote about the Assyrians coming with 185,000 men to besiege Jerusalem. And they were all killed. It was the only city in all of Israel that was spared from the Assyrians. And then we unearth a seal from today's Iran, Iraq, that has the same king by the same name, having declared that he, besieged Jerusalem, had them caught like a bird in the cage, but had to come home empty-handed. How much proof do you need before you say, oh boy, everything it says historically is accurate, everything it's predicted is accurate, and you say, maybe I ought to trust the author?
It seems to be a difficult jump from there to, okay, I trust you now, what do you want me to do? And then you got to read the covenant agreement.
Right. When you
get to that, then they run off and find a religion.
Yeah. Well, let's take Daniel, for example.
Okay.
In Daniel 7, 8, and 9, Daniel is given a history of the world. And he is a captive in Babylon. God tells him exactly how Babylon is going to fall to the Median Persians. And then he tells Daniel exactly the influence of the Median Persians and how they will succumb to Alexander the Great. And how when Alexander the Great ultimately fought, and even tells how he's going to die, Alexander the Great, and where he's going to die. And then it says that out of Alexander the Great's kingdom, four of his generals are going to have their kingdoms.
Mm-hmm.
And then it talks about how Rome, how Rome is going to destroy and conquer the kingdoms of Alexander the Great. Mm-hmm. And while there's animals that are used to depict these various kingdoms, when Daniel says, you know, this is more than I can process, can you help explain it? Well, Gabriel was then sent down, and Gabriel said, all right, that first kingdom I was talking about, that's Babylon. The second kingdom I was talking about, that's Persia. Use these nerds. He said, the next, those happen to be the Greeks. The next, you are still 700 years from the formation of this kingdom, but it's Rome. And he went through and delineated each of the kingdoms and then told us how that while Rome would be destroyed, it would be reborn, and that it's the rebirth of Rome would become the most menacing beast in the history of humankind, and it would continue to prevail until his return. That's the Roman Catholic Church, Christianity.
Hmm.
And so when you read this, wouldn't you think?
Now, does it say they reconstituted? Because they all, you know, the Christian viewpoint is always this reconstituted, that ten from the ten countries that follow the Torahless one. But does it say that it is always there? It never goes away.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. We've come to a commercial break. After the break, we'll talk about what is the reconstituted nature of Rome, and how does Rome relate to the beast? It's an interesting conversation, and we'll base it upon what is revealed in Daniel after we return to Shattering Myths. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with Kirk, and we're talking about end times prophecies. You asked about the beast that is Rome. First of all, Kirk, one of the things that's unique about Rome as the fourth and final beast is that God says it's by far the most vicious. His commentary on Rome greatly exceeds the commentary on the Greeks, the Persians, or the Babylonians. Greatly exceeds it. And his commentary on Rome is horrendous. In fact, I had no idea why God was really so opposed to the Roman Empire until I took the time to write a couple of hundred page analysis of the history of the Roman Empire. And boy, now it's easy to see. Without Rome's influence, Christianity never could have come into to being. Rome actually laid the foundation for their anti-Torahlessness, their opposition to the Torah, their opposition to Israel, their opposition to Jews. All of that was the foundation of that was laid by Rome. What it says is that this beast won't die, and that this beast will not only, because all the others, they have their influence, but it says the beast that is Rome actually terrorizes and controls and manipulates the entire world. And it says the beast that is Rome continues to terrorize and manipulate the whole world all the way to the end of human history. So there is absolutely no distinction between the beast that was the Roman Empire and the beast that is the legacy of Rome that has influenced the entire world, which is only one, the Roman Catholic Church, Christianity. There is this, the 10-nation thing that you're talking about, we'll talk about that in a moment. That has absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with this transition. It has nothing to do with the transition from the beast that was the Roman Empire to the beast that's the Roman Catholic Church. They are one and the same. One grew out of the other. As a matter of fact, who's the founder of Roman Catholicism? Who's the founder of Christianity?
Well, it's always Paul.
Yeah, and what nationality? Not nationality. What?
Well, he chose, what he chose country, his what, Roman side of the family to be on.
He was a citizen of Rome, wasn't he? In fact, he constantly bragged that he was a Roman citizen. He was born in Tarsus in what is today southern Turkey as a Roman, and was proud of the fact he was a Roman. He chose a Roman name. Paulus is a Roman name. It's clear that is the case. That's the Roman Catholic Church that is the menacing influence that actually treads down and is vicious towards the whole world. Now, as it relates to the 10 nations, it talks about Rome being the 10 nations. And one of these days we're going to do a thorough review of this. But Rome was actually had five divisions in the west and 5 divisions in the east. And collectively are the 10 divisions. And what it says is that there will be out of a small and new a country that there that the beast that is the Torahless one. Christians would call him the Antichrist. Although what's interesting is that the Torahless one will be modeled almost identically after the Christian Christ. Yeah, he's an amalgamation of Paul and the Christian Jesus Christ. So he's not going to be an Antichrist by any stretch of the imagination. But the Torahless one, this unique individual that's possessed by Satan, that Satan's primary representative on earth, he is going to come out of one of the of Rome's 10 principalities, and of those 10,
it has to be the eastern.
It has to be because Daniel then 8 says that he's going to come out of the lands conquered by Alexander the Great. And now you might think, well, that's a conflict. 7 says it's coming out of the lands controlled by Rome, and 8 says the lands conquered by Alexander the Great. No, there's an intersection.
Same land they're talking about.
There is an intersection between the two. It's not totally the same. Rome goes much further north and west than does Alexander's conquest. Alexander never moved west of Macedonia, never moved north of Macedonia. And they do cover much of the same territory going east, although Alexander went much further east and south than did Rome. But there is an intersection between the two, and that intersection happens to be Macedonia. Now, Macedonia is a very old country, but Macedonia is a brand new country. Founded in the 1960s, the present country of Macedonia is tiny, it's insignificant, it's new. And so when you go through everything that you can glean that's in Daniel 7 and 8, it becomes absolutely obvious, undeniable, irrefutable. The Torahless one, known to Christians as the Antichrist, is going to emerge from Macedonia. And then he's going to league with and bring under his umbrella of influence 2 other countries. And you're going to have three countries that collectively are under his influence. And then, of course, from that base, he is going to influence the entire world. But his influence over the entire world does not occur until the second half of the tribulation. The first half, he's building his authority. The second half, he's wielding it. So that's how the 10 nations, and out of 10, there's this new horn, this lowly and kind of little and insignificant, that's just Macedonia, and how the beast emerges from there.
Yeah. Now, is that the premier or the president of Macedonia now? Is that a good
thing? You know, it's interesting. You know, Macedonia is really interesting in the sense that it has a very young leader, and the very young leader is mostly economically motivated. He's forming treaties both with East and West. What he's trying to present is Macedonia as this crossroads between the Eastern and kind of Asia and Asia Minor, the Muslim world, and the European world. And he's really not accepted in either camp at this point. But he's trying to form all sorts of economic alliances. The flag of Macedonia is the rising sun. The national anthem of Macedonia sings praises to the sun. The sun is the model, the guise of Satan throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. So is it the current president of Macedonia? I don't think so. I actually think that he'll be a little old because, you know, we're still looking at 2026 before he is dominant on the world scene, and it's 2014 now, so we're 12 years away. I think he's about 40 years old now. Now, that wouldn't preclude him. It'd only make him 52.
Yeah.
And he's a shrewd one. But anyway, it's going to be a Macedonian, and the interesting thing about the current leader of Macedonia is that originally I thought that the Torahless one was going to be a Muslim because it talks about all of his lust for war and the like, and it sounded so Islamic in terms of the depiction of him. But I think he's going to be an Orthodox Christian. I'm convinced of it. The more his behavior and mannerisms are described, the more identical you see the Torahless one, the Antichrist, to Paul. If you look at Paul's personality, Paul's agendas, Paul's writings, Paul's speeches, what you are witnessing is a preview of the Torahless one. They are essentially indistinguishable. Now, can you imagine being a Christian? You're expecting the Antichrist. And this world leader comes out, and he's a fundamentalist Christian. He's an Orthodox Christian. He is spouting Pauline doctrine. And matter of fact, he's even trying to form a bridge via Abrahamic religions to Muslims. And you're saying, there's no way this is the Antichrist. He's a Christian. He's spouting. He's quoting Paul. Yeah, he's on our side. this can't be him. And come to find out, oh man, can you imagine me? I mean, that's going to be unbelievably disorienting for them. Is the notion that Satan's primary leader is going to be a religious Christian? I can't even imagine the disorientation that's going to bring to people. But, no, it's just kind of like a disorientation.
Yeah. Sorry,
go ahead.
No, I was saying by that time you have so many things, you're going to be a little rattle-brained by 2026, 2030 anyway. I mean,
yes, you are.
Towards the end
yes,
of you it. So you're grabbing these straws at that point. Don't anybody save me, save me. What's going on here?
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Yeah, at that point, the restrictions on liberty are going to be so extreme. America is going to crater under its own weight. We will have outstretched, reached out way too many times. We're going to fall under the burden of our debt and under the burden of our military, under the burden of our entitlement program. So America is going to be economic chaos. Most of Europe will be in the exact same way, and the Islamic world will be ablaze in war. The war that we're witnessing in Iraq and Syria now will continue to spread, and it will just be a bloodbath there. So the world will be a very disorienting place. There will be no place you can go in the world and find peace. So, yes, it's already. And most people, when things get that bad, I mean, they'll reach out to anybody who claims to be a savior. I mean, look what Germans did with Hitler. Yeah,
absolutely.
And so that's what's going to happen. Yeah, you look at the first Arabs with Muhammad. I mean, he was run out of town in shame following the satanic verses and the wild winged ass ride to the non-existent Jerusalem and the temple. And yet, once Muhammad led the first terrorist raid against a civilian caravan of businessmen and confiscated people and created a bloodthirst and pirated, robbed them, and they got a taste of stealing, and stealing as a way of earning a living, they just continued to follow him. And, you know, the same thing's going to true with this Torahless one. Little steps, ever so enticing as people look for a way to survive, a way to eat, a way to avoid the anguish, a ray of hope is what he's going to provide. And it's constantly told that he's going to provide a ray of hope that is going to lead to nothing but anguish. And somewhere along this way, Kirk, God completely gives up on humanity. And so it's going to be a bleak period. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Kirk, there's another thing that we haven't mentioned that I think is worth mentioning.
Yes, sir.
As I did the history of Rome, the battles that the Romans fought, the attitude of the Romans, the way the Romans treated other people around the world, and the like, the power of the Roman military might, the nature of its politics, the integration of its military into its politics, and the integration even of religion into the mindset of the Romans. One of the things that I was constantly had to face was there really is very little difference between the Roman Empire and the United States today.
There was a guy who used to talk about that constantly when I was a teenager. He was a preacher, but he, you know, that was his thing, and he went through it step by step, and it was hard to dispute. And I kept saying, "Well, America can't be like that," and I said, "Yeah, they are." And the more I studied, the more they are exactly like it.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, and the moral decay and everything else. And I hope here over the next few days, since I have not the undivided attention of Yoel, because his family is here visiting, but I have the somewhat divided attention of Yoel, is that I will give him the two chapters that I've written, four chapters, but two I think are ready to publish, and we'll add them to book seven of the Yada Ya series on, and those two initially, and maybe three initially. I think I can get three to him initially, which are, the first one is going to be the history of Rome and the history of these beasts and why God despises Rome so much and how it's so similar to America. And the next one, too, will be how the Syrian Civil War ultimately leads to the dismemberment of Israel, the Magog War, and therefore billions of people dying, as it relates to Islam, and the condemnation by God of America is part of those chapters that have been written for some time, just not made available.
Now, have you posted the Daniel 7, 8, 9 that you were working on or further working
no.
on?
No, I've got the first two that I've told you about are both Isaiah 17 and 18. Daniel 7 and 8, the chapters, Daniel 7 is a completed chapter, and I could post that. Daniel 8, the translations are completed, 80% of the commentary is completed, and then I got sidetracked on it, and I got sidetracked really because I wanted to know what I should do with Babylon in the discussion, because the carnage starts with Babylon, and of course Yahweh not only asked Abraham as the prerequisite of the participating in the covenant to walk out of Babylon, but God's last comments to us, as echoed in, he's really quoting the book of Yashaya, Isaiah, is to come out of Babylon. So the influence of Babylon permeates the influence of the Roman Catholic Church. It's the influence of America in the world today, and it's all tied together. And so I found myself just trying to get a more comprehensive worldview, if you will, a bird's eye view of history, of how much of Babylon do I bring up now in these chapters, and how much do I just devote all of Babylon to a series of chapters all by itself, and the integration of religion and politics into the adversary's agenda? Yeah, so it's really hard to know where to start and where to stop when the topics are this big. So rather than completing my writings, I have been doing more research.
I looked up your translation the other day on conspiracy, and the American Standard translates it conspiracy, and there's a Hebrew translation Bible. I don't know. I have to look up the name. I'm upstairs, but it says it translates it exactly the same way. And why King Ives decided to do it confederacy, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah,
pretty lightweight word compared to conspiracy.
Yeah, and there is a confederacy application to the Hebrew word.
We can place together to do something, but that's not what I think of as a conspiracy.
It's the word does not mean confederacy. The word absolutely does mean conspiracy, and the only way that you could move it to confederacy is to specifically not talk about what the purpose of the confederation was. And it's a group of people who come together to conspire through politics and through religion and through the military to impose their will on others. It's textbook conspiracy. There's no question about it. One of the things we'll do, too, is since we've taken the time to explain Yah's antagonism towards the promotion of conspiracy theories. We'll share that as well so that people have a chance to read it for themselves. Yeah, and then the other thing we need to do is also publish the analysis of the food discussion in the Torah, because that too was interesting. We'll be
back. You're a mark.